Het Ziekenhuis, de medische podcast uit Nederland voor het delen van verhalen over diagnostisch redeneren, wetenschap en innovaties in het zorgsysteem. Vandaag luister je naar InnoMed, voor het bespreken van toekomstgericht denken in de gezondheidszorg.
Hello and welcome to our first episode of InnoMed. It's actually also our first English recording that we've done. So welcome and thanks for tuning in. Today with us we have Dr. John Harrison. Dr. Harrison read medicine in London, graduating in 1984, after which he trained in general medicine and endocrinology, followed by a period of research into diabetes at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. Believing that diabetes is essentially an out-of-hospital discipline, he trained in general practice and developed new ways of delivering care for diabetics, in addition to developing research in osteoporosis, specifically focusing on the assessment of biophosphonates. Dr. Harrison worked for over 30 years as a partner in general practice in Northamptonshire, in addition to specialising as an endoscopist in the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. Dr. Harrison is the founding director of Principal Medical Limited, a healthcare provider and general practice membership organisation that's committed to working with local clinicians to deliver high-quality patient care within a range of community-based healthcare services. He is director of pharmacy and occupational health organisations and provides clinical leadership into frailty work for the Northamptonshire Integrated Care Board. Dr. Harrison is a member of the Royal College of General Practitioners and a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians. So, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, so before we start, I think Sarah would love to ask a couple of questions.
Would you be willing to share with us what a moment that has been formative in your career?
Yeah, okay. The formative moments that that always sit in my mind are patient-related. Those are the things that drive us as clinicians, and they're particular people who we reflect on and wonder how on earth it happened or what on earth has happened to them. And when I was a young doctor in London and working in Chelsea, which was in the heart of the city of London, there was a young girl who'd come over as a student from South America, and from being fit and healthy, and from a very wealthy and well-known family in South America, she suddenly became very unwell and developed an encephalitis and eventually died. And that the passage of that illness affected me very deeply at the time, that this young individual could suddenly just die in a foreign country on her own without a family there and without anybody knowing what the cause of the encephalitis was. And as a young doctor, that drove me to do things that helped me to understand how that happens, helped me to understand how little we know about medicine, the limits of our understanding, and the limits of our ability to be able to make a difference in some circumstances, and how that impacts on what we do was an interesting moment in my life.
At what point were you in your studies then, or in your practice?
Yeah, at the time I was a medical registrar in one of the London teaching hospitals. At the time it was called St. Stephen's. It's now known as the Westminster and Chelsea. And at the time we looked after all the, about a half of the HIV patients. So it was the early days of HIV in London. And of course everybody was looking hard for that, but this didn't apply in the circumstances, and any immune compromise didn't apply either. So it was a time when we were all stretching ourselves to understand viral illness in a number of different new forms, and then this came through the door.
You've been in a lot of different educational and healthcare systems. What's your favourite place to work?
Oh, my favourite place to work is London. London is a fascinating city, massive population, enormously complex mix of races and cultures. And it brings with it some fascinating disease, and just the best time to be a medical registrar, where you saw all the acute presentations and were there to treat them. Really great fun.
You've been working significantly in developing changes in the way that we do primary care in England. Would you be able to tell me a bit of a background of what you're doing and how you've got there?
So the problem that we face in our country and in all westernised countries is the huge increase expected in the demographic elderly. And in the UK, over the next 30 years, the ability to be able to care for that population expansion is going to outstrip our capacity. Many of you who've watched healthcare in the UK recognise that that it's in a fairly parlous state as it is. So for some while now, perhaps the last 5 years or so, we've been focusing in an organisation that I chair, and in some of the health systems around the county, other ways of providing healthcare to that elderly population in a way that suits them better, is less expensive, and as a real priority, make sure that we don't make them worse. And some of the interventions that occur and have occurred in the past ostensibly make people worse rather than better. And I'll give some examples of that as we go through, if I may.
Okay, so you're looking at that foundation of work that you've been doing, and you're working across the NHS system. Do you see other voices in the healthcare system that are currently doing work that's similar or different to what you're doing? And does that help challenge you for making the best progress?
I'm certainly not unique looking at this topic. It's worldwide and understood essential for the provision of healthcare in the future. And it comes along at a time where technological opportunities have increased, and the opportunities to deliver healthcare outside of hospital environments is very much greater than it used to be. And anybody who's been in healthcare for a long period of time will recognise this. This goes in cycles depending on what's available in terms of treatment options. And we're definitely on a cycle that needs to drift this back into the community with those who are in that frail elderly category. And it's with that in mind that we're starting to introduce new concepts. All of that is limited by a real lack of evidence and data around what really works and what is financially viable. And so we struggle in a void, which is extraordinary, really, because if you look at the interventions that we can apply in the community that might support people to be independent and fit, the evidence base is almost non-existent. So we work in a vacuum, and we're working to correct that, doing some work looking at the interventions that we're putting in place. But much of it is intuitive rather than evidence-based.
Okay, so when we look at this problem of the aging population, does there need to be a fundamental change? And if so, yeah, how would you implement that, and where would you look?
That does. And recognizing exactly what you say, we have to proceed anyway with those things that we think are going to be of benefit. And it might be at this stage helpful to just describe one of the initiatives that that we've put together around the frail elderly category. What we've achieved, first of all, is that the population of people over 65 in the county that I'm working in at the moment, which is Northamptonshire, a population of about 1 million, the population has increased by about 7%, and admissions to hospital in that category of over 65-year-olds has not increased at all. So there's an effective significant reduction in conveyances to hospital. Now, the problem that we've identified here is that defensive medicine in the UK results in a number of behaviours that are probably against the best interests of patients. First of all, their own wishes. Secondly, their health interests. Hospitals are not always very healthy places, and particularly when there's congestion in A&E and long waiting lists in accidents and emergency departments. So, for example, what happens if an elderly person is in a nursing home very often is that the nursing staff who may be on at night perhaps don't have the senior supervision in place, and if somebody falls or becomes a little more ill, the resources to be able to manage that in the nursing home are not there. And the immediate recourse is to call an ambulance. When the ambulance arrives, they almost have to convey because there's not a safe place to leave them. There isn't the resource to be able to look after them. And they end up in the middle of the night in A&E, which is congested, and there are more pressing people to look after. So the emergencies get looked after first, and the elderly people who are, you know, unwell but not so terribly unwell get left, and sometimes for prolonged periods of time. None of that is good for a frail elderly person. Confusion ensues. All sorts of negative effects can occur by being in a waiting room with ill people. And at the end of the day, it may well be unnecessary in the first place. So there's an expensive conveyance, expensive interventions. Many of them get admitted because of the multiple complexities and the uncertainty about how to manage those and the uncertainty about how to return them to their home. And it's the interventions that surround that that we've been trying to put in place to make sure that they work in a way that works better for patients.
Would you be able to then provide an example of what an intervention such as this might be?
Okay, so what we've been able to put in place in the UK is to encourage all of the GPs in Northamptonshire to work in groups. They're called PCNs. It's a national initiative. But what they've started to do is extended reviews in general practice of frail elderly patients. So they've identified those patients who would benefit from a more significant assessment of their polypharmacy, of their multiple health needs, of their social circumstances, of their non-health related needs, whether they can afford to put the heating on and those sorts of things. And those extended GPs reviews have multidisciplinary teams contributing to them. So it's not always the doctor doing this. It's the most relevant person for that particular person's needs. And this doesn't sound particularly groundbreaking, but it in fact is, because the isolated method by which general practice has operated over the last few decades means that the ability to be able to corral relevant people to be able to serve the patient, the client's needs at home has not been there. And then what happens in general practice is very similar to the description I gave about how the emergency services respond. In general practice, if you have somebody on a Friday night and they become more unwell, unable to walk, lose their balance, get confused on a Friday night, the options for doing anything about that and accessing care that supports them at home are very few, and the recourse is again to conveyance into hospital. So the ability to be able to impact on that and provide those services at an early time and preemptive management, and I'll talk about that in a little bit in a moment, is quite revolutionary and has made really big changes to the way patients are looked after.
Would you be able to expand on the preemptive management and what that might entail?
So many facets to this, but one of the things that we're doing is using new technology to monitor people in their own homes and in nursing homes. So there's a range of new IT solutions that can track whether people are wandering, whether they've closed the door, whether they've eaten today, whether the heating's been turned off or on. Some of the things that used to be done by extended social support by the next door neighbour or the postman if he knocked and couldn't find the person in, those sorts of things that have slipped in cultural changes that have occurred over the years can be done with technological improvements. And there's some really good evidence now that you can track people's health. So if you monitor their blood pressure and pulse, for example, you can anticipate them developing an episode of being unwell several days in advance and then intervene at that stage. So you can anticipate the development of a urine infection, for example, quite surprisingly accurately. And this is now being rolled out into a large number of people in nursing homes in their own homes in Northamptonshire. And another initiative of a similar type is around diabetes. So a population that's historically looked after very badly is the population that can't get into the GP surgery for regular checks. And they are now initiating management where continuous glucose monitors are relayed directly to a central station where they're monitored. And those on insulin can be identified when they're deteriorating and their levels of control improved. Without having to go into the house so frequently and without having the gaps in care that have historically always been there because of personnel difficulty in getting there.
Would it not also require a certain monetary influx at the start to set something up? And is that something that would be feasible to do also in other counties?
Yeah, does any innovative change needs additional funding from the start? And in Northamptonshire, for a population of about 1 million That has been about £7 million per year for the first 2 years of introducing this program. And what we've been able to do with that is very substantial. But of course, it is the peak of the most needy people that we've been able to deal with. So the impact is likely to be greater as that develops, and we will have to then draw finance from existing budgets elsewhere. A difficult thing to do. We will be dealing with people who aren't quite so unwell. And trying to make sure that they don't deteriorate, rather than when they do deteriorate, intervening at that point. And the impact that will have, we're unsure about the cost-benefit analysis of that, but that's secondary to the real benefit, which is keeping people healthy and fit and with a good quality of life in their home environment where they want to be. That's really the driving imperative.
I would assume that there's a lot of competition for these funds. How do you go about attaining them in practice, and what's the reality behind how that's achieved?
Yeah, it definitely is a problem. The hospital sector suck in about 90% of the budget in the UK, and general practice has a little under 10%. And to shift that balance is really very difficult, because it means closing a ward, or it means closing a service. And you can imagine that's an unpopular thing to do.
You mentioned earlier that the data in this area is very sparse. Is the remote monitoring really sort of the first attempt to then acquire data to, in the future, then make predictive models that could be implemented?
It is. And my experience is in the UK, but there is experience in other countries where this is also reasonably well developed. And some of that that modelling of the data is starting to become more useful now, but it really is only over the last 3 or 4 years, which is a short period of time in medicine.
How do you learn these lessons from other countries and integrate them into your own practice?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and absolutely essential to do. It's quite difficult to achieve, both because clinicians need the time to be able to do that, they need the access ports to other health systems, and they need to understand who they need to see and what they need to ask to get the answers that they're looking for. What we have been able to do is look at some health systems, and I'm actually really interested in some of the innovations that you have in Holland around the cohabitation of particularly students in houses where there's spare room, and where they're able to look after appropriate people in the community that might need that care. That's something we don't have in the UK. And I'm very interested in exploring whilst I'm here in Holland. There are other examples, and Israel's fascinating in that it hasn't, for 30 years, increased its bed base, which is quite unusual and contrary to the trend in other developed countries. And the health system there is run around large community clinics by four providers, which people have a choice to which one to take their health care from. And all that diagnostics and the workup and the community-based care for a whole range of conditions that don't actually need to be in a hospital bed are done in those large clinics. And the impact of that, the quality of the care that's delivered, and the cost of doing that is really an impressive model to look at.
So first step is you recognize that other people do things well and we can learn lessons from that. What I would assume the next stage is in how do we make a compelling point for questioning whether that's valuable in our own healthcare system. What are the realities in your experience of that process and trying to implement those or see if it's a compelling argument to make those changes?
So making changes in the UK is really difficult. The NHS is, I think, the largest European employer amongst all European countries, and I still think of the UK as European. A large organisation is very often unwieldy and cumbersome to manoeuvre. The bigger the vehicle, the more cumbersome it becomes. And that ability to be able to learn, even from districts close by, and implement those changes is unreasonably problematic. I'm using the most diplomatic words that I can in this podcast, but to introduce change, even where there's very good evidence that it makes a big difference, is really difficult. And I'll give you an example if that's helpful. It's a slightly different field that we're working in. But in Oxfordshire, we've introduced what's called a community gynecological service. So what we have there is that all routine, non-urgent, non-cancer referrals are made to a community gynecological service. And all of those patients are dealt with by a group of highly trained and very innovative general practitioners with interests in women's health. And what we've found over 2 or 3 years of running this program is that 40% or thereabouts of those people who otherwise would have been referred into the hospital can be managed in the community quite satisfactorily, and with much shorter waiting lists and greater satisfaction to the users. About half of that 40% are dealt with remotely, so advice around dysfunctional bleeding and that sort of subject area, and the other half are seen and have investigations or interventions such as coils or implants, that sort of thing, in the community. And that's some groundbreaking piece of work that is well understood and nationally lauded. But even to introduce that into neighbouring counties is a struggle. And it's a struggle because of budgetary constraints and political impedances and a range of other factors that seem to make new initiatives in new places more difficult than they should be.
So if we look at all these wonderful ideas, actually, what is the reality of implementation? And yeah,
it's a really good question. These ideas are driven by clinicians who are enthusiastic and have time and an interest in driving change. And the other main characteristic of the people involved in this is resilience, because you really do need to be resilient. There are so many pushbacks, and we've started to talk in the earlier parts of this podcast about the limitations of doing this, the frustrations, the difficulties, the things that you have to overcome. But if you ask me what the things are that will really make this spark, it's for that description of clinicians who have experience and credibility sufficient to be able to command the respect and engagement and endorsement of colleagues in all fields, so community and hospital care, and allow them to join you in exploring new ideas. Now, historically, we as doctors have not always been very good at working in teams. Some of the training that I went through when I was young was all about only respecting your own opinion and making sure you checked what anybody told you and checking it again and resting on your own judgment. And some of those training the principles have fed through to the experienced doctors that sit in decision-making positions now, and makes it difficult for them to work together. But healthcare has to be a corporate, collaborative approach now. It's a very different place to 30 years ago. So somehow we have to engage, we have to gain endorsement, we have to develop skills of those people who can really drive change, and allow the health systems and the managers that sit within those to serve, and I use that word carefully because I don't mean that in a servile way, but to serve those clinical imperatives, because it's the clinicians who will really understand what will really work and what really needs to be implemented. Now, you would say, I'd say that as a clinician, wouldn't I? But in all my dealings with some of the fantastic managers in the health service that we have, what they really want is that ground floor understanding of how it really happens and why it doesn't happen well. And that's really a clinical knowledge base that's required.
Yeah. How would you make your changes evidence based such that it had more ground to stand on?
Yeah, we're wrestling with this problem at the moment. Innovations are just that, and have to be without a good evidence base. They have to be intuitive and based on understanding of need, and then the measurement and the research comes after that. And we're at that stage now where we're starting to think about that. And it's really very challenging. So in a hospital environment, research is very often very difficult anyway, but is much more precise and scientific. In the community environment, there are so many variables, and the interventions are often quite soft, that to measure the impact of those in an environment and a population that is changing anyway requires big populations and big investment. So it's not impossible, but it's quite difficult. And I'll give you an example of that. One of the things we do in Northamptonshire is something called a pumped up class. So for people who need primary strength and balance interventions, or secondary, or tertiary, in fact, once that, you know, if they've been out of hospital and after breaking the hip or something of that sort, they can go to exercise classes, balance classes, and there's some good evidence for that particular intervention that it improves their quality of life, the mobility subsequently. So key markers like mobility can be measured after a key intervention that's discrete. And that's one area where there's good evidence now. But other interventions that are probably just as important, such as a befriending service that deals with and helps loneliness and supplies people to read with elderly people so that they have some social contact during the day, and somebody to say, I don't feel so well to today, and somebody to call when it's appropriate, when they can't. Those sorts of interventions are very soft, and to actually develop an evidence base is quite difficult.
So in summary, you would say yes, there's a place for evidence, but clinician intuition is just as valuable in certain sectors.
In certain sectors and at stages in the development of these projects, but you're absolutely right. At some stage, there needs to be an evidence base that's stronger than there is now.
So up till now, we've discussed the greying population and it made it all seem very rose-colored, but there's, of course, also a population with a less socioeconomic status, which historically might be underrepresented. And how would you handle such groups?
It's a very good point. And what we've been able to do in the UK and particularly in Northamptonshire is work very closely with community groups, voluntary sector, and what's called the social services or the county councils, who now have a responsibility for public health. It used to be within the healthcare sector and it's now within the county council budgets. So there's a real joint working around frailty between the agencies that can make a real difference to those sorts of problems that you've identified. And they're very real and they're very different in different geographies. So the particular geography that we look after is sometimes very deprived urban and sometimes very deprived rural, the rurality being about social isolation and lack of transport. And in the cities, being about ethnic minorities, drug misuse, and drug misuse, of course, not usually in the elderly, but in the populace around those elderly people and the houses that they live in. So the ability, and we're really in the very early stages of this, to actually make a difference to housing and actually provide transport, which is one of the next big pieces of work that we're doing for those who need to get to community centres or areas where dementia can be shared as a problem between individuals who are suffering from it. Those sorts of interventions are blurring the boundaries between health and social care in its widest sense and provide the opportunity to answer the questions that you've identified. But I wouldn't say that we are a long way down that path yet. We're just at the start of that.
How do you decide what's good enough in the care that's provided?
And this is one of the big unstated challenges that all Western healthcare systems are grappling with. They're so very different now from healthcare systems in underdeveloped countries. And we have to at some stage initiate a debate about where good enough sits. The perfection that's required in many environments in medicine, and rightly required, has to let it sit alongside realities of finance, staffing availability, other resource availability. And I don't think that debate has developed sufficiently to be able to give any good answers for this particular podcast, but I feel that I've been doing a reasonable thing to initiate the discussion. The answers are not there, but they need to be there. And the medical world doesn't have a mechanism, as far as I can see at the moment, for defining what is good enough in any one particular environment. And that's particularly obvious in the frail elderly category, and it's going to be an imperative for that. But it's also the case for many others, where things are done in a particular way. And just to give you an example of that, dermatology around, so surgical dermatology in the UK around 10 years ago was defined as being a hospital specialty. So when for years and years, GPs had removed basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas, for example, they no longer advised to do that. And that's overwhelmed the hospital systems, who were defined as having the best possible service available. But in overwhelming them, we've effectively defeated the objective by having longer waits and lack of availability of resource. And the confounding effect of trying to do it perfectly has resulted in many areas in a less good service. And that's an example of where, a realistic discussion at an earlier stage about what is good enough for the vast majority of people would have served the population better than the drive towards perfection in every circumstance. So a difficult debate, one that needs to be had, and one that I haven't got great answers for, but one that needs to be talked about.
Okay, coming then into the final phase of this episode or this show, I'd be really interested to know, what's the main lessons you've learned regarding this topic in your career that you bring with you now?
That's a good question. And I suppose the main lessons that I've learned are some of the ones that I've previously identified. And so I would say that that you have to first, so for aspiring clinicians coming through now, what I'd absolutely love to see is that when you develop the experience and the ability that you feel very confident with, you look to a role that will really expand your ability to be able to make a big difference to populations. So many of us, and myself included, who've worked in general practice, are very focused on the individual in front of us and perhaps relatively small populations that we look after. But the opportunity to expand on that and make a really substantial difference to large numbers of people is only delivered through organizational change and ability to be able to provide healthcare where people need it. So to develop an interest in that field, however difficult that is, and however resilient you need to be, is something that I wish I had identified earlier in my career. So I've come to the organizational element of it quite late. Perhaps that allowed me to do it when I might have not been able to do it at an earlier stage because of those reasons for credibility. But if you had somebody who was able to identify that at an early stage in the career and have 10 or 20 years really making a difference, that would, if I reflect on my own life, that would have been, I think, an advantage to me. So that's one thing that I think has been a sort of a revelation as I've got perhaps a little bit older than I would have wished. The other thing that I think I would say is absolutely fundamental. Medicine, in its widest sense, is quite siloed, and to develop an ability to be able to walk across those individual silos, and gain credibility across disciplines and individuals, is something that's not taught in medicine, and is absolutely fundamental to being able to do some wider work. And I think if I had realized the the need to do that at an earlier stage, I would have probably made more rapid progress. The organization that I set up 20 years ago now has 300 staff. So it's a medium-sized organization, but it was very slow growing. And I think that could have developed much more quickly had I known more about what was needed at an earlier stage.
Looking into the future of healthcare and medicine, what excites you the most?
What excites me the most about healthcare is being able to deliver something that will serve my needs when I'm in that frail elderly category, and happily it's you guys who are going to be looking after me when I'm in my dotage. So what I'd really love, what I like doing, is the creative and the developmental stuff. It's akin for me as developing in art or the arts, making a play or doing a film, making a film. So I love to see the expression of the ideas that I can generate with others, and see that make a real difference to populations. That's what really drives me.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating to discuss this with you, and I hope we can bring these key learnings into our future clinical practice. Bedankt voor het luisteren. Als je hebt genoten van deze aflevering, like en deel met je vrienden en collega's. Wij zijn ook te vinden op LinkedIn en Instagram. Zoek maar op Het Ziekenhuis Podcast. En tot de volgende keer.